began to fail in its output. Then, in due course, I had to dismantle it, find out why it was failing. 99 times out of 100, a part that had become worn out. Find the new part, fit it, close that particular machine up, and then run a test. And report back to the chief ERA, such and such a pump, such and such a bit of apparatus is fit for service again.
As far as living arrangements were concerned, the artificers
artificers' mess.
Yes. Their own mess.
Four artificers and a stoker to look after us. He cooked the pudding. He made the puddings many a time. I've seen him stirring the requirements for a pudding, and he would inquire, what kind of sweet do you want tomorrow? And there would be a little note amongst four of us. Oh, figgied up for currant pudding or apple tartlets or something.
And what were the duties of this ship whilst you were on board? What were the duties of this particular ship whilst you were on board?
At sea, watchkeeping. Entirely in charge of the engine room department from the engine room.
Charles Simpson, Reel 6. And where did the ship serve?
Mostly in home waters. It was attached to the home fleet. So we went to Scotland on many occasions, where we joined up with the so-called home fleet. All ships used to congregate from all the depots. Every class of ship used to make its way twice a year to North Scotland, so-called Invergordon. And there, from there, we used to carry out the same kind of fleet manoeuvres as we had previously had in the Mediterranean. So we used to emerge from this great harbour in order, battleships leading with admirals in command, followed by the cruisers, then the destroyers, and then the minor vessels, and then the support vessels. Exactly the same, but in cold home waters and not warm blue Mediterranean waters.
How did you cope with the change in climate?
Mostly by haunting the engine room in really cold climate. We would sit around the hatchway leading down to the engine room. Each department is entered by a round opening above which you can fasten the hatchway. Now, under calm conditions, the hatchway is allowed to be open. And it was a practice, both in rough weather and in cold weather, to congregate around the engine room hatch. The engine room hatch had a protective sheet around it, and you could huddle behind this bit of protective sheeting out of the wind. And when it was cold, you would find two or three people, maybe the chief stoker, because there was one chief stoker on board, who got very friendly with the artificers. After all, he was the chief stoker, second only to the artificers. So maybe you find one artificer and the chief stoker in cold weather, huddled round the engine room hatch, sitting in the hot exhaust from the engine room.
any other ways you tried to keep warm?
Yes, by going into the engine space. But we had a very nice little mess, just four of us in the stoker. Very warm, very cosy. So we spent most of our spare time in the mess. In very good weather, of course, on the upper deck. The artificers had a special part of the upper deck reserved to them. This was called B gun deck. And only artificers slept there in good weather, finding a convenient place to lay down or sling a hammock. And that was the exclusive rest place, recreation space for the artificers.
Did that happen on other ships as well? Did the artificers get part of the deck on other ships?
Yes. Until I ceased to be an artificer, I knew where to go in my time off. In good weather and when away from home, I'd go to our particular bit of the ship, taking lighting gear with me, and either study or read a book or write home.
Can you tell me exactly when you were on this destroyer?
Yes. I came home in 1934, went to Crusader in March 1935.
And how long did you stay on Crusader? This is the destroyer we're talking about now, isn't
it? Yes.
Yeah. How long were you on, or should say in?
In the Crusader?
Crusader.
2 years. 2 years. And then I was taken out of the Crusader. And I received a plum appointment. I was sent to join the ship HMS Impulsive, which was building in the shipyard in Cowes, Isle of Wight. My home was still in Portsmouth. And I crossed the Portsmouth Harbour every morning and every evening from Portsmouth to Ryde, and then made a journey from Ryde to Cowes every day for several months before the ship was completed and became a real ship at sea.
And what did you do while she was being constructed?
The purpose was to become acquainted with every nut and bolt in the ship, and to be enabled to find any part of the engine room department or the engineer's responsibilities in the dark. So we pored over the ship from bows to stern every day. And I did something a trifle unusual in that I carried notebook and pencil with me, and I traced every single pipe in the ship from its beginning. If it was a water pump, then from its force of supply to its delivery point. And day after day, I crawled through the department, and it was a crawl, because the ship was not finished. Oil fuel, all important. I crawled through the ship and traced every inch of every pipe, marking on my little drawings all the valves, so that at any time thereafter, I could either refer to my memory or refer to my drawing where the valve requiring to be opened to empty the number one oil fuel tank was, and where the intermediate valves were between the tank and the delivery point in the boiler room. So that occupied my days.
Were you accommodated?
No, I had to go home.
So you were able to see your family?
Yes, every day, including Saturdays.
And how did you spend your free time at that?
Pardon?
At that point? How did you spend your free time at that point in the evenings? Did you go out? Did you go to the cinema? What did you do?
Oh yes, at weekends, from Saturday lunchtime till Monday morning, I was as if on leave. So, cinema, playing tennis, still walking with my father, helping around the house, and relaxing, just being an ordinary young man about 10.
Dare I ask, any girlfriends?
Oh, yes, yes. But you see, even at that time, I had the future to look forward to. I knew that in a given number of years, only 4, I would be an engineer officer and no longer an artificer. So I took a very great interest in all matters of mechanical and marine engineering. Mostly just behaving like an ordinary young man of 24, 25.
You'd gone into the Navy in peacetime. Were you aware that there was a war, an impending war, on the horizon? At this point?
Yes, we were beginning to be aware of it. I would guess about mid-38. Now, you remember, I already knew when I was to be promoted. And I was promoted on the 1st of July, 1938. I was 28 years of age, and I became a warrant engineer.
How did you feel about the fact that war was on the horizon?
Not very strongly. At that time, and until the very moment we were told the war had started, I was unable to relate my duties in peacetime with my possible duties in wartime. You see, there was no damage control organisation at that time. Nowadays, an artificer would spend a considerable amount of time learning what his duties would be in wartime. But at the time I became an engineer officer, my duties in wartime would not have been very much greater than in peacetime, merely to take charge of fire parties, to know how to pump out compartments when flooded, how to economise on fuel consumption, having nothing to do with any other department other than self-preservation and keeping the ship afloat should it ever be damaged. But in those early pre-war days, you only thought of these things in a vague sort of manner. War can, for us normal shipmates, came as something of a surprise. Not totally unexpected, but in 1938 I gave no thought to the war. I was engaged in learning how to wield my sword, how to salute with my sword.
Once you become a warrant officer, Was there any training that you had to undertake before you were able to serve on a ship?
Not from the engineering aspect. It was only from leaving the lower deck and beginning to lead the life of an officer. In the case of the warrant officers, they had their own mess referred to as the warrant officers' mess, which was like the wardroom, but on a lower social scale. But it had the same privileges of dining, of having wine to drink at dinner time. In the majority of aspects, an officer. But when parading, for example, a warrant officer would fall below the lowest commissioned officer, a sub-lieutenant. But in all other respects, he was an officer. He was saluted when joining the ship, saluted when leaving the ship, entitled to go into the stern sheets of the boat taking one ashore. In every respect except rank, an officer.
Can I ask you about the warrant officer's mess? You said you had the same privileges as the wardroom. Can we just elaborate on what those were? For example, dining. Did you have stewards to serve your dinner?
Well, the greatest privilege, of course, was to have a cabin. Even the smallest and best kept artificer's mess, as in a destroyer, was still a mess. And you still slept in it, ate in it, rested in it, wrote your letters in it, spent your spare time in it. Now, as a warrant officer, you became entitled to a cabin. And this was a place to which you could retire, frequently alone. But in some ships, where there were a number of officers, and cabins were limited, it was not unusual to have two warrant officers sharing a cabin. But it was still a cabin, as opposed to a mess deck.
What was the first ship you served on as warrant officer?
My very first was HMS Nelson, which was the flagship of the Commander-in-Chief of the Home Fleet. And I attributed my appointment to the fact that I had been a candidate for sub-lieutenant, that I was a failed sub-lieutenant, but a pre-routine time promotion to warrant officer. You remember that I gained 6 months seniority because of being a failed sub-lieutenant.
When did you join HMS Nelson? What year did you join HMS Nelson? Was that
1934. 1938.
And you've talked about having a cabin.
Yes.
The warrant officer's mess, how was that run?
By the senior commissioned warrant officer. All warrant officers were in the same mess, whether they were engineers, bosuns, gunnery officers, electrical officers. This was the first time when I had sat at a table with anybody other than an officer. So the great and enormous advantage was to come into contact with other warrant officers and commissioned warrant officers of other departments. And we all got on like a house of fire. The president of the mess was the most senior commissioned one officer. And the commissioned one officer was promoted from the warrant officer at, if I remember rightly, 8 years seniority. It was an automatic promotion, subject to having good reports from your captains.
And apart from the mess, what about your laundry? Who did your laundry? Did you have a separate bathroom, all that sort of thing?
Laundry was done by arrangement with your cabin steward. You could still do it if you had enough audacity. You could still do it yourself if you wished. But you would still then be faced with the business of where to dry it, if not in your cabin. But the usual practice was to hand it to your cabin steward, and then he took it away and he got it laundered wherever he could. There were no laundries in the ship at that time, and no Chinese laundrymen, not in the home fleet anyway. So it was a matter of a cabin steward doing it in his own bathroom somewhere.
And was your food served by a mess steward?
Oh, yes. Royal Marines. Royal Marines served several functions in a big ship. They were not only soldiers, they were bandsmen or stewards. And in the Nelson, Royal Marines served at the table, just like hotel waitress, trained to behave like table waitress. In other words, they put a bowl of soup in your place and waited till you finished and removed it. And when I became a warrant officer, I had 6 weeks instruction along with perhaps 30 or 40 other warrant officers of different departments. We combined to do a 6 weeks divisional course, during which we were taught to bow, how to tie a bow tie, how to wield a sword, how to salute, how to dine in the officers' mess. We were instructed where to lay knives and forks for a formal dinner. We were taught to wait until plates were removed. And I had one excruciating experience when, for the first time, we wore mess dress with bow ties and mess jackets. We assembled for our first practice mess dinner. We were to follow the ship procedure. After the soup, there was an exceptionally long wait. And everybody, including the mess president, was beginning to look more and more and more dissatisfied. The wait could have gone on for 2 or 3 minutes because plates were laid and taken away together. At the end of this, what seemed to be an enormously long wait, a Royal Marine's hand reached over my shoulder and put my soup spoon in the middle of the plate. I kept the entire table waiting until I put the soup spoon in the right place, which was the middle of the empty plate.
But you didn't do that again.
You learn fast, even how to take your soup.
Earlier on, you mentioned the fact that being a member of the wardroom would involve an additional expense. Did being part of the warrant officer's mess mean that additional expenses were involved as well?
Yes. Have any particular...
No, earlier on you said that being a member of the wardroom, you were told, would involve additional expenses.
Yes.
Presumably for wine and...
Yes.
Other
luxuries. Well, the warrant officer's mess, to which I first belonged as an officer, was very much the same as the wardroom, but on a much lower level, in that although the wine bill allowance was the same, every officer was allowed to spend £5 a month on intoxicating drinks, and that was the same in the wardroom, and you were hauled in front of the captain if you exceeded it or endeavoured to do so. There were mess collections. You were expected to contribute to all those ships' funds on a much more handsome manner than the ship's company. If the ship was engaged in any charitable pursuit, like orphans, and a collection was made, then every member of the ship's company, it would be hoped, he would contribute on the level of giving commensurate with his rank. So one found that in the warrant officer's mess, you had to put 10 shillings in, whereas an artificer you might be expected to only put 2 shillings in. Not that that happened very often, but it's an indication that as a warrant officer you've found yourself involved in expenses. Now, in the wardroom, these were much higher because the wardroom did a great deal more entertainment of officials, of public people. And then, of course, the expenses incurred in dining people in the wardroom had to be shared by the members of the wardroom. So, yes, there were expenses which, although I didn't suffer them when I finally joined the wardroom, because, of course, by then I was earning a salary that enabled me to meet the expenses. I would have found them had I not, had I joined as an acting sub-lieutenant.
HMS Nelson was the flagship,
yes,
of the Home Fleet.
Yes.
What differences did that make to your life, the fact that there was an admiral on board? Actually, before we go on there, I'm just going to announce the next reel. Charles Simpson, Reel 7.
Joining a flagship meant a great step up in relationship as a person, as an officer, to the ship itself. It was rather like saying that you were a professional footballer and you stepped from the first division, which is being a very good footballer, to joining a team in the Premier Division. Still a footballer, still playing the same game, but in a much higher bracket. Same game, but a great deal more prestige attached to your club. It was precisely the same in the Navy. Ships of the same class